Top 100 Project is sponsored by Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug starts with premium Arabica beans that are always fair trade. They offer a variety of delectable blends and roasts to choose from. But the best part is that Sparkplug delivers this outstanding coffee to you in Canada or the US within 1 week of custom roasting it here in Toronto so that it always reaches you fresh and at its peak flavor. And you will taste the difference.
What about Transylvania?
You can order Sparkplug as you need it, or you can get automatic deliveries through the Autopilot Coffee Club. It's not a coffee of the month club. No, it's completely flexible and customizable with all the convenience and none of the commitment. And if you tell Sparkplug where you heard about them, they're going to give you 20% off your next coffee order. Just use the promo code TOP100PROJECT at checkout. And that's all one word with the number 100. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. Plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Sounds so high-tech and modern, I will stick with the 1800s.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Good evening, creatures of the night, and thanks for listening to Ellis's Analysis episode number 410 here on the Top 100 Project. We are the Monday morning exploration of films from long ago. Our archive is filled with all sorts of classics, including every last one of the 123 choices made by the American Film Institute for their 1998 and 2007 Top 100 lists. Like a big, beautiful puddle of blood left out in the sun, we spoil. Can I put that stuff in a fridge? Or so I've been told. I'm the unblinking lady killer who travels light, just a few boxes of dirt when I go from Europe to a different part of Europe, many hundreds of miles away. Ryan Ellis. And here's the Abbey buyer who often drinks wine. My wife, Bev.
That's me.
Well, she used to drink wine. Not so much anymore. You drink other types of things, including, well, I guess the wine you like now is the rosé.
It's true. I've had a very rosé summer.
Or even white.
I didn't like white or rosé wine until my 40s, but man, I really embraced it.
Okay, the coming attractions opinion question for a very famous film, very old film, Dracula. I would say the original, but I guess in a way that was Nosferatu, which we covered 4 years ago, I believe it was. So that's the same story as this, but the F.W. Murnau movie. That was 1922, this is 1931. Anyway, the one people think of as the original, whether they're right or not, is this one. And it is the first of the Universal Monster movies, because it was the same year as Frankenstein, but earlier in the year. Okay, so Dracula has been adapted and bastardized dozens, maybe even hundreds, of times by now. So let's recast Dracula yet again. Who would be an ideal choice if they launched yet another lavish production of Bram Stoker's Main Man?
So I like my vampires like I like my coffee. Hot. I like a sexy vampire. So initially I was thinking of someone like Jude Law or Michael Fassbender. Someone with intense sex appeal, but also could pull off that aristocratic air.
So you're saying Jonah Hill?
Definitely not. But then I thought of the best idea, and that is Cillian Murphy. He looks really otherworldly, but he's still so strangely appealing. He could definitely seduce me to the underworld.
He's got the eyes, for sure. Still a good-looking guy, too.
Oh, yeah.
He was in A Quiet Place Part 2 earlier this year, and still looks pretty good for a guy who's not exactly young anymore.
Hard agree over here.
My choice, and I thought of this immediately when I first thought of the question, Ian McKellen.
But he's so old.
Hang
Dracula
on.
Dracula isn't supposed to age.
Well, hold on a second. We know he can act, as can Murphy.
Well, yes.
He'd be appropriately ancient-looking, because he's really looking old now, when he's dying for blood. And that's the Nosferatu movie more so than any of the Dracula movies, because usually Dracula, and so many of the adaptations, is a relatively handsome middle-aged man, rather than, I'm not getting enough blood or any at all, so I look like this desiccated corpse type thing.
But he's supposed to be a desiccated corpse at the beginning of the movie,
and I know.
Then he drinks all the blood in London.
I did say we're adapting this and changing a little bit. I just like the idea of Ian McKellen doing this, but then here's the real kicker. Because he could also do the dashing thing, help him with makeup and rosy up his cheeks and stuff. And in my version, he'd go after men. Ian McKellen.
Oh, that would be great. I was also thinking it'd be cool to do a version of Dracula with a woman as Count Dracula or Countess Dracula.
I have a thought for that, too.
Yeah.
Michelle Pfeiffer.
Yes to that. Oh, my God. I want to see that movie now. How come no one's really done a gender-bending version of Dracula? Because it would be so interesting to see what you could say about society, what kind of allegory it could be when it's a dashing woman. seducing young men.
There have probably been gay vampires, being Dracula, for example, or women vampires, but in movies we haven't seen.
Isn't Lost Boys a little bit gay vampires?
But I mean the actual Dracula story.
Right.
Or whatever they might call it. Because, of course, they did Blackula back in the 70s, I think it was. So that's blaxploitation.
Oh, also Interview with Vampires. So
clear. I know. I thought about that when I did the McKellen thing. But Pitt, and even Cruise to some degree. Well, more so Cruise, actually. He did buy into that because he always gives 100% or 205%, if you will. But Brad Pitt, his character, I don't know if the actor is not willing to do it, didn't buy into it. So I want to see two men get into the idea of it. And again, I'm sure that's been done, but not in a big, lavish production like I'm talking about right now.
It's such a versatile story and becoming a universal human tale. Bram Stoker was really onto something with this.
Well, there's a lot of subtext. There's some right now. Fear of Foreigners was released 90 years ago by Universal Pictures on Valentine's Day. Valentine's Day. Maybe that's appropriate, actually. Bit of a love story in a very odd way. In 1931, people showed up in pretty big numbers to check this one out, and they got to see Lugosi become a legend. So, Bev, please remind us what the movie's about with the Dracula skinny right now.
Bela Lugosi is Count Dracula, a mysterious aristocrat in Transylvania who employs a solicitor to help him move to London, driving him mad in the process. Once in England, the Count meets and torments the Seward family, killing a family friend and turning their beautiful daughter Mina into a vampire like himself. With the help of Mina's fiancé, John, Professor Van Helsing tracks down Dracula's daytime resting place and slays him in his coffin, an act that returns Mina to her mortal self.
Her father wrings his hands and, "My word, heavens, what do we do about this, Van Helsing?" And then Harker, "I'll save the day, hands on the hips."
Van Helsing does all the work, really.
Yeah, he really does. The other two are pretty much useless, at least in this version. Not so much in other versions, and I'm sure those versions will come up plenty in the next little bit here on the podcast. Well, my nutshell actually hits home to something that just happened yesterday. We officially got our house. We haven't moved yet,
but we officially got it.
So, in a nutshell, Dracula, 1931, night shift worker becomes real estate investor.
Night shift worker.
He works nights.
Fair enough.
That's how this movie ends. Not with a bang, but with a whimper.
And I do have to counter that. He was leasing the house they keep talking about. He says it's a lease. He didn't buy it.
It doesn't fit my story.
That's the journey that we took. We're not leasers anymore.
Right. Bev, I'm 47. I just bought a house. Let me have this.
First house. It took us a while. We were a little behind the curve on that one.
We do live in Toronto.
Yeah.
Okay, the Rotten Tomatoes critics on Dracula. 94% of them are in favor of this movie. 7.8 out of 10 was the average. 47 reviews are on there, and 81% of audiences. Pretty strong. Maybe not surprising, but pretty strong. The movie was put in the National Film Registry in 2000, along with movies we've covered, all AFI films, Network, Apocalypse Now, and Goodfellas, and 21 others, but those are the ones that stood out, and we have covered them all. And those are three of my favorites, period. This isn't. Dracula was 85th on the Top 100 Thrills. Psycho was number one. It was 83rd on the Top 100 Quotes with Children of the Night, listen to them. What music they make. I may have gotten that a little bit wrong, but that's the spirit of the quote. Children of the Night especially. And Dracula was 33rd on the Top 50 Villains. And more for the fame of the character, although this is a pretty legendary rendition by Bela Lugosi. Anyway, 33rd on that list, and Hannibal Lecter, a vampire in his own way, in some ways, he eats people, was number one. I know we've seen this movie before. You said we saw it on Halloween quite a few years ago. I forgot we watched it together until you reminded me of that. I've seen it several times. It's part of a pack with Frankenstein, Bride of Frankenstein, both of which we've covered, and Creature from the Black Lagoon. I like the two Frankenstein movies better than this. I understand why people like this movie. I think it's okay. It certainly isn't scary. I'm not a raver of this film, the way the Rotten Tomatoes critics are. In fact, it's actually kind of funny sometimes, unintentionally. But your thoughts, please.
I guess you really had to be there.
There you go. That's good.
Even critics who retroactively praise this film as a masterpiece readily admit that it's really stagey and creaky and clearly a film that suffered from that clumsy transition between silent films and the sound era. Mm-hmm. Nosferatu is an immeasurably better film than
more
this.
More creepy. Well, I wouldn't say scary either, but closer to being scary than this is.
Definitely closer to being scary than this is. With a better villain, all the praise for Bela Lugosi. I believe the reports that people were so freaked out by him and that he was such a great version of Dracula, there must have been an impact there culturally. You guys can't hear this, but Ryan is giving me a pretty intense stare.
I don't have the eyes for it. My eyes don't open far enough.
And maybe it's because there was no music cues to go along with it, or because it all just seems corny to us, because every version of Dracula from here on out was based on Bela Lugosi's performance, including things like the Count on Sesame Street. We grow up with this almost cartoonish Count Chocula version of Dracula, of being the least threatening and most accessible version of vampires. So it's pretty hard to feel afraid of him with his slick back hair and his cape. All these things just feel silly and childish now. Whereas at the time, he really did freak people out. We were talking about how the film has really strange pacing. There's no score in this film, which we both agreed was a huge deficit.
Usually you don't like the score in movies. Over and over again, you've said that in our podcast, but this is one time where it should have had some.
Well, it seemed like it was shot and edited as if it was leaving space for score. Something would happen, and there would be this really extended, long beat of the camera lingering on Lugosi. And I guess we were supposed to feel something, but we didn't. You said, chances are, in the movie theaters at the time, people were reacting. Also, you have a director who came up in silent film, used to arranging for films to have accompanists.
Live in the theater.
Piano players accompanying along with the film. That goes for the editors of the film. Everybody was still working as if they were making a silent film that was going to have a score added after the fact. All these things make it just look bananas when you watch it now. I don't want to call it unwatchable frame by frame. The cinematography is really beautiful. The sets are really incredible. Those big castles, everything in those scenes is such an add that it does make it a much more watchable film, but it's really hard to imagine watching this in 1931, watching this without all the cultural baggage that's been piled over and over and over onto the character of Count Dracula since then.
Yeah, it's very dated. Now, we did Frankenstein probably, I have to look back, 5th, 6th podcast maybe ever for us, because it was so early in the project. Same year as this, same studio, of course. I think it came out in the fall. Like I said, this is Valentine's Day of 31. So this is really the blueprint for how Universal monster movies were made. And horror movies in general were not common in the sound era. Obviously, they'd been made in the silent era. You mentioned the director, Todd Browning, is who you're talking about. So he did The Unholy Three, which is in the silent era. And then the year after this, he did Freaks. And he did a lot more than just that. Just like Lugosi had made several films. He'd been working for 14 years before he did this movie, as was true of Boris Karloff with Frankenstein. He'd been working for a long time before he played one of the most famous horror characters of all time. Here, a villain, that one's not so much. That's a victim, really. The monster's a victim. Lugosi didn't play this character very often, though, the way that Karloff... Well, he didn't play Frankenstein's monster that often himself. Lugosi did play Frankenstein's monster, I believe, at one point in their series. They made so many sequels and so many ripoffs of these two films. But yeah, we can't really imagine Frankenstein and Dracula, I don't know if you've ever seen the original Mummy or some of these other pictures we've talked about, truly being scary to people. We can believe that they thought they were scary. I told you the story on Frankenstein about how dirt hitting the coffin of one of the people that the guys dug up later, and then, of course, part of the body became part of Frankenstein's body, Frankenstein's monster's body. That freaked people out. And then seeing people who'd been hung, which you don't really even see. They've already been hung, and that's why these two guys are pillaging the bodies in that movie. That whole thing freaked people out. And then this zombie-type character coming back to life made people uncomfortable. I believe Frankenstein, if it had a music score at all, was very sparse as well. This just has Swan Lake in the opening credits. I think we heard it at least one more other time in the movie. And also when he goes to the opera and he meets Mina and Lucy, there's music playing because he's in an opera, so he's actually hearing the overture, I guess, at that point. But otherwise, there's no diegetic music or music period, and like you say, that really would help, and it probably would have made Frankenstein that much stronger. I don't recall. That may have had music, but I don't think it did very much either.
I don't remember Frankenstein suffering the same deficits as Dracula. I don't remember Frankenstein feeling this awkward and stilted from scene to scene. And we very recently covered Bride of Frankenstein, and I don't remember it having these problems either.
I just thought of one reason why this movie may have freaked people out. Probably back in 1931, when you went to the movies, or obviously the actual theater, the opera, that kind of thing, any of those types of night out type of thing, men would have been wearing top hats and capes, full three-piece suits, looking aristocratic like this guy would have looked. So maybe their date, their wife, or just strangers looking around, and there's so many men like this, But I thought, oh my God, that guy looks like Dracula. I've been watching for an hour and 15 minutes. The movie isn't long, although it doesn't feel like it's an hour and 15. It feels like it's about an hour and 45 at least, if not even longer. But maybe that's part of it. If you were to go to some kind of screening, like in Scream 2, because that's our next movie, Scream, and they're all wearing the Scream mask when they go to see the making of what they call Stab, well, that's a plot point at the beginning of Scream 2 as well. But that would maybe put you in the moment even more. So maybe that was part of what freaked people out, seeing this aristocrat who just woos women. Of course, there's a lot of subtext. We said that already. A big one is, and this plays in what I said before about fear of foreigners. So a foreign scourge, this is really true in Nosferatu even more so, because he's more of a disease, effectively. But a foreign scourge comes to seduce our women and overpower us physically or just with our stare and our presence and wreck our country. He took our jams. So that's always been the subtext in the Dracula storyline. It's really blatant in Nosferatu.
In Nosferatu, it's like a metaphor for plague, as I recall, because there's many villagers who die. It's a mysterious thing that's taking their lives, because it takes them a very long time to figure out that it's him. Plus, he just looks like death. He looks like a rat that really did make people sick not that long before that movie was made. So when I think about him as a foreigner, that's a threat, a foreigner that brings disease, where you might look at this version of Dracula as a foreigner that comes and, as you say, seduces the women. There's so much sex as a subtext in this version.
Well, it's a metaphorical rape, what he's doing to them.
Absolutely.
We never see fangs in him, though, in this movie at least, maybe in the other sequels when other people play Dracula, actually, in the other remakes and whatnot. Christopher Lee played Dracula a bunch of times. By then, you had fangs. There's a pretty famous shot of him bearing fangs, blood in his face. But there are no fangs in this. You never see the bite marks. They talk about how the women have been bitten, but we never see any evidence of this. We do see a moment where Mina, after she's been bitten by Dracula, is eyeing up John's, and they always call him John, but he's always Jonathan in almost every other version of this movie, including the 1992 one where Keanu Reeves plays Jonathan Harker. But it is a little bit weird to hear him be called John, wearing his, what do you call those, jodhpur-type pants. That's the way people dress, but he looks so ridiculous. Oh, stop that, man! You don't look like you could stop a fly, which is what Renfield wants. So try to stop a fly for him. You probably couldn't. And then he can eat it. That's the performance you thought was the best in the whole film. Dwight Fry, who's also in Frankenstein. He's Fritz. People think of Igor as the assistant. Well, it was Fritz in the very first Frankenstein film. So he did these two in that 1 year. He worked a lot. He did a lot of other Frankenstein movies beyond the first one. But he got typecast.
There's a scene in this movie where he's crawling on the floor towards the camera that is scarier than anything Bela Lugosi does in this entire runtime.
And why is that?
Okay, because he resembles Bob from Twin Peaks, the way that he's moving, but I feel like it's his actions that are scary. They're sharing the same creepiness.
Well, he eats the scenery even more than Lugosi does.
Love it. I need it. It's more interesting than... Sorry, I know this is sacrilege, but Bela Lugosi, I don't know. Do you get it? I don't get it.
I get why they would have liked it at the time. I don't think it's so good now, of course. He's also still the most famous version of this character, probably. That's why I brought up the idea of who else could we find to do this. We could find a lot of people that could do it. But in my notes, I've got over and over again, Renfield raves. He raves again. He raves some more. He's probably the second lead in a way because he's the one early on. In most versions of Dracula, we hear about how Renfield was there before. I know the Coppola one in 92 was like that, where it's Tom Waits.
Yeah, he has a much smaller part in that movie. I think he's just in the mental institution eating flies.
They talk about how he had been there, but in this, that's who we're seeing. We don't really see that much of John until, I don't know, maybe 25 minutes in. We don't even meet Van Helsing until the 30-minute mark.
It's kind of a hard movie to see who the hero is. Because initially you think Renfield is going to be the lead character because he's the one introducing us to the situation, going to Transylvania, meeting with the Count, going to his big castle, and then he just goes mad and becomes Renfield, and then he's eating scenery, yes, but he's an autonomous character who affects the plot very much. He's just there to freak us out. I guess you could say John is the main character, but he also doesn't really affect the plot that much. He's just wandering around watching other people do things, watching Mina get bit, watching Van Helsing go after Dracula. He's in all these scenes, but he doesn't seem to really have much agency as a character.
David Manners plays him. People ripped on Keanu, and Keanu was not good in the Coppola one, but this guy's worse.
Yeah, he's not great.
Maybe it's Browning's direction. I don't know.
He's handsome. Kudos, you did cast someone hot.
He's got the 1930s brunette man look, though.
Oh, very much,
Very generic. He was in The Mummy the year after this. And The Black Cat. So he did a lot of horror films in this era. Apparently he ripped on Todd Browning's direction and the movie itself. It's not like you're good, dude. It's not like you're bringing everything else to your level. maybe it's the script's fault. A lot of people had writing credit on the screenplay, including Browning himself. Of course, they based it on the Bram Stoker book in 1897, but also the 1924 play. And it's really more the play that's adapted because it was cheaper to adapt. And that's one reason why this is so contained. It's mostly shot in a studio, although it's obviously set in two different countries, supposedly Transylvania. Well, it's not a country, but anyway. Romania, I believe, is where Transylvania is.
I think it was Hungary at the time that the book was written. And okay. Then it was Romania by the time this film was
and
made.
And different parts
of
England.
They set it in Hungary because it's supposed to take place in the 19th century.
And then different parts of England, obviously, but most of it was in the studio. A lot of matte paintings. You talked about the sets being impressive, and they are. This is the era where they would have enormous sets that were built in these enormous studios, but there were an awful lot of matte paintings as well. When we see Dracula and, of course, Renfield in the very beginning, there's a lot of unusual animals in the castle, too. And you could see the wires and the bats. That's not unusual, of course, the vampire story. But you can also see leashes or something on armadillos and the holiday armadillo. Whenever I see that word or hear that word, I always think of Friends, Ross wearing the holiday armadillo outfit. Basically, the trainers are just barely off camera, and their equipment is not off camera. It's on camera. But yeah. It's a weird touch. Armadillos with vampires? Whatever.
I know. I guess it's just weird.
Maybe that's lunch for the vampire.
They're an American animal, right?
Oh, I don't know, are they?
Southwestern America? I'm not sure, but I thought so. Not that it would matter. They shot the film in California, so armadillos were probably handy.
That must be what it was, yeah. Well, when you see rats and bats, which is the cliche in vampire films, they're just more weird and creepy and everything. I've got a few of those props, and they'll be out on our front lawn for Halloween. They definitely do enhance an actual scary lawn if you want to have one rather than a goofy one. Armadillos aren't frightening. Some of the other animals they show aren't frightening.
Also, the plastic bats that we have are almost definitely more realistic and scary than the bats in this movie. I know it's 1931, and they were pretty limited about what they could do, but it seems like they didn't even try with special effects. They really just phoned it in. There's those bats that look as corny as it gets, and then there's the fact that we don't really see him bite the necks. We don't see him emerge, even just to dissolve something to represent the bat turning into Dracula. Instead, they always cut away and cut back like it's a cheap television show. We've seen other films earlier than this that have had pretty dramatic special effects. Maybe not the most convincing, but good-looking special effects. I'm thinking of Sunrise, A Song of Two Humans, mm-hmm. which covered that like 8 years ago. But that film was Murnau. Was it Murnau?
That was Murnau.
Yeah. There was a lot of superimpositions that looked quite beautiful in that film. And I know that they would have been hard to do at the time, but you had a budget for this movie and it's a supernatural thriller. And you can't even put a dissolve in there to represent this thing happening. You can't try harder than those cheap plastic bats that they would linger on for way too long. It's one thing to have a pretty bad special effect like that, a bad prop, but they would let the camera sit on this corny bat for so long.
Do the Jaws thing. Have a flash of the shark.
Yes!
Don't dwell on the shark.
Use the sound effect of a bat. Like, you see it really briefly, and then just the sound effect kind of fills in for it. Now, again, these are tricks that they probably hadn't learned yet because they were still used to working with silent film.
And horror, especially from a big studio, was not a common thing. I don't know if you could call this the first horror film made in Hollywood.
The first supernatural horror, big studio film that was a supernatural horror film.
And the same time they were making this movie, at night, on the same sets, a Spanish language Dracula was being made, and it's on the DVD. You have to choose which one you want to watch.
With all different actors.
But yeah, the Spanish language version came out in 1931 as well. And when I was looking at the Rotten Tomatoes stuff, just like when you go on IMDb, there's so many Draculas. But on Rotten Tomatoes, I didn't look closely, and I maybe should have. It looked like it said 100% for the 1931 Spanish language one of critics.
Maybe that's
so
what
everybody
we
that watched it. Maybe it's four people that all liked it. But let's go back to that beginning. I guess we're at the beginning anyway. But Renfield, when he first gets to Transylvania, and he's asking the villagers about going up to the castle, don't go up there. That is said so many times. They really dwell on it. Borgo Pass. Don't go to Borgo Pass. The villagers also care too much about this man they've never seen before. Don't do it. Oh, X. Don't do it. They should be happy. Dracula and his ladies have other blood to drink. This guy's fresh. He's a young, healthy, buxom man. Let them drink his blood for a while. But Renfield's also the weird one in this storyline. We said a minute ago that Tom Waits plays the same character. But the idea that he isn't a vampire the way we think of him. He wants to eat bugs. He wants to eat animals. He wants to eat these little things. He'll even settle for flies. There's not really much blood in a fly, if any blood at all. But he wants the rats. He wants that kind of blood. And it's almost like Dracula programmed him that way. This isn't a defect or the way most of them could go. The women certainly don't go that way. Oh, maybe that's the idea. Because Dracula, in this version anyway, does bite Renfield himself. He forces his brides away, and he's the one that feasts on him. So maybe when it's a gay thing and he goes after a guy, the guy doesn't react the way most vampires do. But if the women had bitten him, maybe he would have been a typical vampire wanting human blood.
Well, I'm assuming that this is from the book in this version of Dracula, and also in the Francis Ford Coppola version from 92. Dracula is pretty skilled at imprinting thoughts on people's mind, glamoring. He can really glamour people.
He does it with Mina. He speaks to Renfield in ways we never actually hear, and he does it to Mina,
but he does it
and
to
Lucy.
The nurse as well. When he wants in Mina's room and they've done everything they can to keep him out, he brainwashes or whatever.
They've done some things to keep him out. Not much. Not enough.
At least hang out.
We said that
more
this,
than one person.
While we're watching, we're saying, if you are so afraid of this guy, well, the nurse is there, so that's all we can do.
So he hypnotizes or glamours the nurse, and she takes a wolfsbane away and opens the window, and it's as simple as that. Not every version of vampires leans that heavily on that ability that vampire has. And maybe that's how he made Renfield the way he was. He wanted to drive him mad. He wanted a loyal servant, but he didn't want somebody who was going to compete with him for human blood.
Okay, yeah.
So he convinces him that what he really wants is the blood of rats and spiders. He just does what his master says. He's such a devoted servant.
Okay. Maybe this came up in Nosferatu, but I have to tell the story again because I always love that moment in Shadow of the Vampire. Willem Dafoe plays Max Schreck, one of his best performances, just completely disappears into that character.
Another actor who would play Dracula, who would be great as Dracula.
Yeah, sure. Good choice, too. But when he's talking with two of the producers about the movie, Murnau, give me that book, meaning the actual Dracula. What'd you think of it? It made me sad. And what made him sad was the idea that this creature, this former man who's been alive, in a way, for hundreds of years, but hasn't had actual food for the longest time, has to go get supper for, I think it's Harker in the book. But anyway, he has to get food for a human being. How does he know how to prepare the food? He has to get the right bread, the right meat, the right cheeses. Made me sad. Because, of course, he's an actual vampire himself in that storyline. And that's one of the underlying sadnesses of this whole story. Yes, Dracula is a villain in all these versions. Well, I'm sure there are versions that we don't know about where he's completely the anti-hero or even the hero. I guess that's true in the Adam Sandler Hotel Transylvania series because he is the hero of their storyline. He has a daughter and everything else, and he's Sandler playing him. So that's one version where he's the hero. But yeah, the idea of living forever, this has come up in our podcast a few times. Vanilla Sky in some ways deals with that because the guy may have killed himself, but in a way he's still been alive for 150 years and he's now going to be made alive all over again. Not a vampire, but of sorts, I guess.
Dr. Sleep very much dealt with that.
That's right. That was our previous podcast. I'm out of order here. Vanilla Sky was a couple weeks ago. Dr. Sleep. Yeah, anyway, would you want to live forever?
No, hard no.
No, I don't think so.
I barely want to live to 80.
Living to 50 is asking a lot. So that's one thing that most movies had never gotten at. Shadow of the Vampire deals with it a little bit. And the Nosferatu is because the one we watched and reviewed a few years ago. But also, I think this is in the version that Werner Herzog made in 1979 with Klaus Kinski. Another good piece of casting who does look mostly like the 1922 Max Schreck one. Maybe a little bit more dashing, but not much more. But the idea that you've been alone all this time, you've been eating people effectively, sucking their blood, but basically eating them. For however long you've done this, you've taken women away from their fathers or their husbands or their friends, all that kind of thing, and made them your vampire slaves in your castle for all this time. And that's all terrible. But you still have to get by. You still have to have a version of a life yourself. They don't get into this in Shadow of the Vampire. How boring that would be. One of the reasons I wouldn't want to live forever is how dull that would get after a while.
Yeah, right. Just like you said, super lonely. So Shadow of the Vampire is about the making of Nosferatu. It's like a fictionalized version of the stories that came out from the making of Nosferatu. Max Schreck was a total bona fide weirdo who had this aura of creepy mystery. People thought either he took the part too seriously or he really was not a vampire. But, oh, well, that movie does kind of say that he is a real vampire, right? And Bela Lugosi kind of shared that with him, that he was way too involved in the part. He fought really hard to get it. He worked for less than he was worth. He worked for $500 a week, which I guess wasn't very much at the time.
But he had done this on stage first.
He played it on Broadway. He had performed it like 350 times. And initially the studio didn't want him, but he really campaigned for the part. And now, of course, he's synonymous with the character. So it must have been the right move in many ways. But the cast and crew described this ritual that Lugosi had of dramatically posing in front of a full-length mirror, throwing his cape over his shoulder, and shouting, "I am Dracula!"
Which was his first line in this movie, by the way.
Yeah. He didn't talk to anybody all day. He didn't hang out. He didn't socialize. He would say good morning. He would say good night. But he was super weird.
A lot of people who play horror villains.
To his craft.
Freddy Krueger. So that's Robert Englund. He did not mingle with the actors who played the kids in the first Nightmare on Elm Street. There are a lot of stories about people who played horror villains who've kept away. I believe that's true about Gunnar Hansen on Texas Chainsaw as well. And I think some of the Jasons have done that in the Friday the 13th series. So he was method acting. And I hear you tell that story and there's a little bit of contempt in the way you told it. But I'm also thinking of, I love him too. He's a great actor. But I'm a little bit tired and have been for a long time of Daniel Day-Lewis gets so into roles. What's the difference?
Well, people didn't like him. You know, that could be part of the reason his career didn't really go that far after this, when he struggled. And initially he said, I'll never play Dracula again. I'm totally through with this role. I don't want to be typecast. But I don't think anybody really cast him in much else. And his career dried up and he did end up playing Dracula again. Of course, famously, the last movie he ever did was Plan 9 from Outer Space, which is a complete mess. He obviously only did it for the money.
Playing a vampire-type character.
Notoriously considered one of the worst films ever made.
Yes, he was ending with movies like that. And as I said before, had worked forever before this in other films. There's also the whole thing about how he had to do the thing phonetically because he couldn't speak English. But I was reading recently that that wasn't true either. It's just, this is how he spoke. He has an accent. Look at Schwarzenegger. He's been in Hollywood, or at least America, for all these decades. Don't you eventually shed your accent when you live somewhere else for more than half your life? But he still sounds the same as he did when he first got here, maybe a little bit better. Well, I guess that's true about Lugosi, too. He sounds about as good as he ever did in this movie when he does speak. And there's nothing wrong with him having an accent. That is also part of the subtext, I guess, that Stoker put into that. And I'm sure that was going on with this film, the idea being that here's a foreign menace who, like I said, is coming to mess us all up, ruin things, and metaphorically rape our women. Yeah, and kill them as well. Whether or not he actually rapes them, even metaphorically, doesn't even matter so much if he's going to flat out kill them, because he does. Lucy, such a small part of this storyline, but she's so key in a lot of versions of this storyline, because it's almost like the testing ground. We like Lucy, we care about Lucy, but Mina, everybody cares about her. But we see what happens with Lucy, especially in the Coppola version, and how she becomes this creature of the night. They have to do these awful things to her that these guys can't believe they're doing, but Van Helsing knows enough, and it does work. That's like a dry run for what they may have to do to Mina.
You have to see the peril that Mina's in by seeing what Lucy goes through. So yeah, it's a metaphor about sex. It's a metaphor, or rape. It's also a metaphor about virginity. All vampire stories are about sex. Dracula is a seducer drinking blood tenderly from someone's neck. It's erotic. And once the vampire has fed on a woman, she's ruined for other men. There's that scene where Mina goes to John and she's like, "We can't get married because I'm ruined now." She seems totally fine, and he's like, "What are you talking about? Just like somebody who had lost their virginity would still be a perfectly intact woman. Nothing actually changes about your body."
I knew you were ruined when I met you, but oh well.
What? You were my first on our wedding night, dear. But it's like a metaphor for how, because she has been touched by another man, she has now been spoiled. Her virginity is no longer intact. She's no longer a real human anymore, worthy of marriage.
Religious angle on that one, for one thing. You can almost call a vampire, at least this one, a terrorist. Well, what do the... We heard about this after 9/11. The suicide bombers get when they go to heaven, according to what they've been told. 72 virgins. Why they gotta be virgins? Why 72? That's such a weird thing. But for me, I won't want a virgin. At least a couple of the 72 of experience. Teach me some stuff.
Well, the value placed on women's chastity is a conversation for a whole entire other podcast.
Well, this story also does have religious overtones as well, or even undertones. That's certainly here. We have a crucifix. Again, we'll mention the 1992 version. I love when the crucifix comes out and Dracula screams at it and sets it on fire. I guess you could say that's telepathy in a way, too. Almost to say that means nothing here. But usually that's one of the big signs. Just like, not wolfsbane, but garlic. This movie doesn't have garlic, it has wolfsbane. But that's usually a big thing. So the crucifixes are, you got to put a stake through his heart, that happens. But here's the one thing about this movie that I always remember being so anticlimactic, and maybe they couldn't afford to do a, I don't know, I guess that wouldn't be a big cost. Maybe it was more about censors, but this seems to be before the censors were a big issue. Maybe it was self-censorship. But when Dracula dies that night, he's taken Mina out again, and she's gone to him before and been bitten repeatedly, apparently. So she's going to her attacker over and over again. She's going back to her abuser, if you will. He kills Renfield finally, after all that time, puts him out of his misery. But then he just goes to bed. Because
well, he has to if Dave.
Well, the dawn's coming, but yeah. It's funny. There's no big climax. He just goes to bed. They find him, and you hear it off screen where Van Helsing.
He's killed off screen. Who made this choice? And you're right. It could have been something where they just thought, well, we can't get away with actually showing him get killed in any way whatsoever. But it is treated with the chastity as if it was a sex scene in the 30s. The camera just pans away. And, oh, it happens in the distance. We kind of know that it's going on.
Van Helsing is penetrating him.
And you know what else is funny? Van Helsing is like, John, you take Mina. I'm just going to go find a piece of wood I can fashion into a stake. You knew where you were going. This is your whole thing. You're a vampire hunter. You don't have a stake ready to go. You have to whittle a weapon. We're all waiting.
He breaks it off the coffin, but yeah.
Still, what a disappointing, anticlimactic ending. If you were afraid to show that, then you have to find some other way to give the audience a satisfying ending with the villain.
Yeah, because that's happening here. Dracula makes some kind of sound.
Like, we can watch Renfield die. We watch him fall down the stairs and die.
Decent stunt.
It's a great stunt, and he's such a good performer. So if we can watch that, why can't we watch Dracula die? He's not even human.
And seconds after the, from Dracula, the movie's over. John and Mina are walking up that long staircase. Credits.
Yeah. Apparently, there's a cut scene where after the credits roll, this dude is standing on a stage in front of a curtain, and he's like, ladies and gentlemen, you probably just saw this movie and were afraid that there really are things like vampires, and I'm here to tell you that there are! And then they cut it because they were like, what if people believe us?
Edward Van Sloan, I believe, did that. He's the one who plays Van Helsing.
Oh, thank
because
you.
He did the opening of Frankenstein and was almost like, oh, if you're worried about being scared, then don't watch this movie. The Simpsons have parodied that. They parodied everything. Where Marge comes up for one of the Halloween spectaculars, Trios of Horror episodes, and warns people watching the TV show that we're going to try to scare you in addition to making you laugh. And those episodes, they always did try to make the Halloween episodes and the Simpsons be a little bit scary in addition to being funny. So that's why Van Sloan did that. So he's in both movies, but he has the beginning of one and the end of the other one. So he's one of the many people that were at some point or another in these two series. Some of them were literally in the same two movies. Fry was Fritz in Frankenstein, and Van Sloan was Dr. Waldman in Frankenstein. So the very same year, but that's a studio thing for you, though, too. If you look at this era of acting, sometimes you see people with 10 roles, but that's because they're on a studio lot, so they can work from maybe even not a week, but maybe it's Monday to Friday on one movie, and then the next week they're another one. That's why cinematographers, even directors, made so many films back then. But most of this stuff was shot in studio, so it's not as hard. The lighting grid's up there for years.
Right. You finish a film on Thursday, you start the next one on Friday.
Mm-hmm. Truly a factory mentality back then. Helen Chandler does play Mina. She made 26 other movies, including Christopher Strong. And I was reading about how Helen Chandler thought she was going to be this huge star and wasn't, and then basically imploded. Not the only person that's ever happened to. That's what happens in Mulholland Drive, I guess, right? Mm. That's the storyline there. She's fine as Mina. I didn't think she was all that impressive.
I thought she was pretty lovely. I mean, she's demure and pretty and convincing as somebody that you would be tempted to protect. And she's another one of the actors in this movie that confirmed the story that Bela Lugosi was super weird on set. And another one of the actors that kind of rolled their eyes and was like, oh, that movie. Valen Sloan as well was on record of saying this was not his best movie. He wasn't proud of it at all. He never would tell people to watch it or recommend it.
Funny though, because the average person probably knows Bela Lugosi's name. And they don't know anybody else in this cast.
Fair enough.
Film fans might know some of these names, but even I didn't remember most of them. Dwight Fry and Edward Van Sloan when I saw the... Oh, right. I remember their names from before. And, of course, in Frankenstein. But most of these people... Herbert Bunston as Dr. Seward. He's dreadful. He's the doctor. He's got a really key role. He's also, in this version, Mina's father. Like I said before, just wringing his hands all the time. And, oh, what are we going to do, Dr. Van Helsing? So Browning apparently was an absentee director in this movie in a lot of ways and wasn't really truly committed. I don't know. I think he was more into doing Freaks the next year. That's a movie that definitely freaks me out because, I'll be honest, they're weird looking. It's hard to get past that.
And they cast real, quote, freaks in that movie.
Yes,
right?
And that has a very memorable, haunting ending.
One of us.
Yes.
One of us.
Well, they've mutilated somebody, truly mutilated them. So he's not a name that's remembered now, but...
So you say that, and on Wikipedia, it names him as the director, but it then says Carl Freund is the uncredited director.
The cinematographer, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe Browning really was Brian Singer then.
Yep.
Not really the actual director of his film. Well, Carl Laemmle Jr. was the producer and the studio head, and I read this online, then I looked for it in the opening card, and it does say prescient. of Universal Pictures, not president. They missed the D.
Oh.
How do you not get
that
right?
Yeah, that's right. We saw
that. George Lucas must have been going crazy. I could fix that with visual effects. So he produced 127 movies in 14 years, including two we've already done. All Quiet on the Western Front, which was the year before this. Not a bad sound movie, actually, for that time frame.
Agreed.
And then Bride of Frankenstein, he produced that as well. And Browning was a producer on this, too. So Browning had writing credit, some producing credit, and the director of the film itself. Apparently, Lamley made changes in post-production and recut the film, and Browning did not like that. He said it ruined it entirely. You said it was choppy, so maybe that's true. The actual editor was Milton Caruth, who worked on The Mummy, and then eventually Shadow of a Doubt, which we've covered as well, the Hitchcock movie.
Great movie. One of my favorite Hitchcock movies.
So maybe it was the producer that was the problem here and not the actual editor or even Browning shooting it.
Could just be growing pains. People didn't know what to do and they were just leaning a little too heavily on the things that worked in silent film.
The movie's 1-2-0-1. We watched the black and white DVD I mentioned before as a four-pack, effectively, four movies in one thing. Well, I got to show you Creature from the Black Lagoon. We probably won't review it, even in 2024 when it's 70 years old. But you do have to see that maybe, and you got to hear the music cue
that
plays over and over and over and over and over and over and over. It's a good cue, but they play it so much. You mentioned the cinematographer was Carl Freund, who did shoot Metropolis, which we'll probably do next year. Very famous film, of course. And he won an Oscar for The Good Earth a couple years after this. We talked about Milton Caruth cutting it, and there's no real score. Swan Lake plays. That's pretty much it. And we already said before, there's a big hole where that music is not. What happens next? Harker goes to Transylvania and claims that castle for his own. Metaphorically, rape my wife, will ya? Well, I'm taking your house. It'll need some renos and an exorcist. But look at the upside. They do have to kill off three quote-unquote women, though. They're still there.
Well, the women, I guess, will turn back to human. Because if Dracula dying changes
that's
the
true.
People he's
every
turned
version
back
of this,
humans.
The ones I can think of anyway, Mina is no longer a vampire once Dracula dies. Mm-hmm. Yeah, true. Mm-hmm.
Pretty common vampire thing that if you kill the head vampire.
So it's their house then. Look at the upside. Get rid of those weird animals and it's all yours, ladies.
There you go.
Or go back to your family.
Three sexy ladies.
Your family's
for
probably long dead.
So I know we've talked about the cultural impact. How do you even measure the cultural impact of this film?
It's enormous.
But yeah, Bela Lugosi's performance will always picture him as the default Count Dracula. His accent is Dracula's accent. His slow, corpse-like affect. That's Dracula's affect.
The eyes.
Oh yeah, the eyes, definitely. That glare. But imagine if Nosferatu had gotten wide release like it was supposed to, because when they made that movie, they were just trying to basically steal the intellectual property of Bram Stoker's Dracula. They were cheating the copyright laws by changing just enough details from the novel to rip it off. But then Stoker's estate took them to court. They won, and the verdict was to destroy every single copy of the film. And they almost succeeded. And as a matter of fact, if you've seen Nosferatu, chances are you've seen an incomplete version of it. Actually, I don't think a complete version of it exists. There are scenes that are always going to be missing. We'll just never know if we're seeing the actual intended theatrical copy of Nosferatu because of this court decision, which is such a freaking tragedy. But even as it is, Nosferatu is just such a far superior film. Max Schreck's performance is in a whole different category from Bela Lugosi's Count Dracula. He's just so much more creepy and unsettling. So I really wonder if people had seen Nosferatu then, which they didn't, it was kind of rediscovered decades later, would that be the blueprint for what a vampire was supposed to look like and sound like and move like, rather than Bela Lugosi's version? You could do a whole what if of the cultural impact of vampires if Nosferatu had actually gotten the wide release it deserved.
I am the Watcher here to ask. What if?
It was intentional. I want Marvel to do a version of the world where Nosferatu just got away with it or just paid for the rights so that everybody could just see that film. Now, mind you, it was a German film, so it's possible it just wouldn't have had the impact in America, although silent films traveled a lot better than talkies.
Speak whatever language you want to. It doesn't matter. The title cards will be what they need to be for different countries. But yeah, generally, Dracula tends to be the aristocrat.
And a gentleman, well-dressed.
Who's going to seduce the women. Well, he's raping them effectively in this different way. He's raping them. But he called a seduction as well. And that's not at all what the original Nosferatu, and I'm assuming, I don't remember, I haven't seen it in a long time, the Werner Herzog version is, which is, no, I'm going to eat you. Okay, then. Last thoughts on one of the more famous 90-year-old movies we've ever covered. Whatever faults it has, and it's got a lot of them. Dracula.
If you really want to watch it, knock yourself out. Or watch it again. I guess you're not going to listen to this podcast if you haven't already seen it. Yeah, this one I can't get behind. Just a classic.
It's eerie, I guess, at times. And this is such a famous version by Lugosi. But it isn't scary anymore if it ever was. Gotta call it quaint at best. I'm glad it's part of that set. I don't know if I'll watch it again for a long time.
It's corny at worst.
Mm-hmm. I haven't seen Frankenstein, I don't think, since we did it for the podcast. But I would watch that again. And, of course, we did Bride of Frankenstein just last year. And that's the best one of those four in that pack. Okay, well, we are not quite in Scary Movie Month, but in 7 days we will be. It'll be October by then. Scary Movie Month can officially begin. We'll keep the thrills coming as we talk about Wes Craven's meta-slasher flick with almost as many laughs as there are chills. Scream! Should have been called Scary Movie. That's what they intended it to be called. And, of course, the parody version of it by the Wayans brothers was called Scary Movie. All right, the coming attractions trivia question for Scream. As we've just discussed, Dracula was nominated for 3 AFI lists and made them all. How many AFI lists did Scream make?
All right, so for the answer to that question, check out next week's podcast about Scream. And for more from us, in the meantime, you can visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to favorite or subscribe wherever you listen. All of our episodes are available for free, and there are hundreds of them. They include all 123 movies that made the AFI's 98 and or 2007 lists of the best American films ever made. And in exchange for all this, while you're there, maybe you could leave us a rating and a review. We really appreciate that because it makes it easier for people to find us. We're both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. You can also reach us by email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And to enjoy freshly roasted premium coffee delivered straight to you in Canada or the US, please go to sparkplugcoffee.com and use the promo code top100project. It's all one word, top100project. It's not case sensitive. And that will get you a 20% discount.
With respect to our coffee sponsor, let's go drink wine.
And cut.
Come here.